Friday night, I'm going nowhere. All the lights are changing green to red. Turning over TV stations, situations running through my head. Looking back through time, you know it's clear that I've been blind, I've been a fool. To open up my heart to all that jealousy, that bitterness, that ridicule. Saturday, I'm running wild and all the lights are changing red to green. Moving through the crowds, I'm pushing. Chemicals are rushing in my bloodstream. Only wish that you were here. You know I'm seeing it so clear. I've been afraid to show you how I really feel. Admit to some of those bad mistakes I've made. And if you want it, come and get it. Crying out loud, the love that I was giving you was never in doubt. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and fail in now. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and fail in now. Babylon, Babylon. Sunday, all the lights in London, shining sky is fading, red to blue. Kicking through the autumn leaves and wondering where it is you might be going to. Turning back for home, you know I'm feeling so alone, I can't believe. Climbing on the stair, I turn around to see you smiling there. And if you want it, come and get it. Crying out loud, love that I was giving you was never in doubt. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and fail it now. Let go of your
good afternoon and welcome to our program. You're listening to an EquiVoices program. EquiVoices is a program that brings new perspectives, practices, and discussions on multicultural mental health, focusing on fairness, justice, and equality in health-related matters across diverse cultural backgrounds. I am your host, Moa Chisenga, from the Australian Sickle Cell Advocacy South Australia Chapter Incorporated. We are a registered charity whose aim is to raise awareness of sickle cell disease in South Australia and advocate for persons living with sickle cell disease. I am joined by my lovely co-host, Masonda Chisenga.
Hello.
A young lady living with sickle cell disease. We are very excited today to introduce our guest, and our guest today is John Mannion, CEO of Breakthrough Mental Health Research Foundation. Welcome, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you on board. We have a lot to unpack, but I guess as we were catching up beforehand, just tell us a little bit about what work do you do at the Breakthrough Mental Health Research Foundation?
Yeah, sure, no problems at all. So thank you very much for inviting me to join you on the show, and hello to all your listeners. So I have the pleasure of being the CEO of Breakthrough Mental Health Research Foundation. We are a for-purpose foundation that's based here in South Australia, although we do have a national footprint. And our focus really is to generate investment and funds into mental health research. And we focus that on four very specific areas around young people, Indigenous mental health, depression, and eating disorders. And the reason of that focus is so we can support the growth of the South Australian research community. But the work in which we do is a little bit more extensive than that. So we have an arm of the work that then looks at how do we actually connect, how do we actually educate the community? So how do we look at the training we put into place for mental health literacy? How do we build those skills within that community footprint? Especially around the most people's very first mental health conversation isn't with their doctor. It might be with their loved one. It might be with their partner. It might be with their best friend. It might be, their sports colleague. So the more knowledge we have around mental health and the mental health narrative, that makes it stronger for us. And then ultimately it's around connection. How do we connect people? You as a foundation are coming together to educate but bring people together with a shared passion for driving a change within sickle cell. Breakthrough is exactly the same. We're driving that narrative for normalizing the mental health conversation. So it becomes an everyday conversation and not one of those special ones or one of those ones that happen behind sort of closed doors. So as a foundation, we support research here in South Australia across at SAMRI and UniSA and predominantly across Flinders University. But we're looking about how can we sort of support the best research wherever that may be. So our aim and objective is to develop research grant rounds that will connect with the wider Australian community and drill into those questions around why do mental health issues actually happen? What can we do about it earlier? What's the early intervention we can put into place? And ultimately, what's the prevention? So we have a vision to help create a life free of mental illness because we never talk about the cure for mental health, do we?
No,
No.
and I
So,
was actually intrigued by that.
yeah, so I thought that as a foundation, if we were to be bold and say, well, let's strive towards that. We don't accept that cancer takes so many lives, yet we still haven't found the ultimate cures, although we're having some really positive impacts. We don't accept coronary heart disease is a major killer. We don't accept diabetes is yet in our mental health world, we've accepted that one in five of us will experience a mental health challenge today, that 44% of us will experience in our lifetimes, that 50% will have our first presentation between the ages of 11 and 14, and 75% of us before the age of 24. And we lose 9 Australians to suicide every day, of which 7 are men. And we shouldn't accept those statistics anymore. We need to do something about it. So that's what the aim of the foundation is, to try and drive a change in those statistics, because behind each number is a mum, a dad, a brother, a sister, a real person and a real story, and we want to make sure we don't lose that.
Oh, brilliant. No, I'm actually, when I was again, and thank you for sharing those statistics, quite sobering, 1 in 5. So yeah, it's not as distant as we would imagine, as an abstract. But maybe for the sake of a person who's maybe just hearing about mental health, when we're talking about, because it seems to be a buzzword in a way, when we're talking about mental health, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, if we look at it in simplistic terms, there is no health without mental health. So we have physical health and we have mental health. The two are interrelated, interlinked, live together. We can have positive mental health. So I'm looking after myself. I'm resilient. I've learned a wide range of skills to look out for the signs, the symptoms, the triggers. I'm sleeping well. I'm eating well. I'm managing distress. I'm able to communicate effectively. That's when, the world's a good place and we're at our optimum. But what happens when that balance gets tipped out? What happens if there is a trauma that occurs? What happens if we get a diagnosis for an illness? What happens if we have a change of life circumstances? What happens if we're being bullied at school? All of a sudden, our sleep gets impacted. our relationships get impacted, the way in which we communicate alters and changes, the way in which we care for ourselves all of a sudden stops. So the things we used to do that we used to love being involved in, all of a sudden we disconnect from. The sports club that we always went to for training each week, we've disconnected and decided no one would notice if I wasn't here. And then we have those ultimate feelings of worthlessness. So no one would notice I wasn't here. I'm not worthy to be part of any team. Why would anyone want to know me? In fact, if I stop going to places, no one would actually notice.
Yeah.
And we start to talk about that hopelessness. So that's when the conversations around suicidality may occur. So we know that we actually live on this continuum. You know, not one of us ever has, you know, we get up in the morning and it's like, oh, the day's a beautiful day and everything's fabulous. And it's a beautiful world. Most of us go through this fluctuation, don't we, of ups and downs throughout the whole day. Now, majority of us are able to manage that on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
But what happens when those feelings become prolonged? What happens when they last more than 2 weeks? What happens when they stop us enjoying things or participating in things that we used to enjoy doing? What happens if it changes our behaviours, our thoughts and our feelings? That's when it's becoming a mental health issue.
Okay.
So along that continuum, we have mental health, and we all have it, through the deficits of our mental health or the challenges we're experiencing may cause a mental health issue, which could be anxiety, it could be depression, it could be psychosis, it could be trauma, it could be grief, it could be loss. So there's many different moving parts within it. So it's quite complex, which goes back to the question when no one ever talks about the cure. It's because there's so many moving parts. There's not one thing that just triggers it. And what might cause distress for me, you might not get distressed by. And every one of us is unique in that way.
No, thank you for that. And I guess one of the statistics, I guess you were also, I picked up from your organization is about, you know, that nearly 60% of all medical health funding bypasses research and goes directly to, I guess, what you call them, deployers. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. We had a gap analysis completed by Ernst Young Australia, and we posed the question to them, if we look at where the mental health dollar goes within Australia, where can you track it? Where does it actually sit and fit? And so what it identified was there was a high percentage of funding then goes direct to organisations that say, you know, we're going to address this, we're going to fix it, we're going to change it, we're going to alter it. Yet 60% of everything and every intervention we put into place has no evidence to prove it works.
Oh, wow.
So the drilling down into, you know, programmes we put into place or interventions we put into place often get missed out. So this is where we're saying, you know, well when you're looking at services that are developed, is that an evidence-based intervention they put into place? Is there research sitting behind it to prove its efficiency and its effectiveness and the positive outcomes for people? And we're finding that there's still a high number of interventions that don't have that evidence. So we wanted to invest into research that started to ask some more of those questions. So one example being we have a program that was run in the south of Adelaide through the youth mental health team, and it's called Dialectical Behaviour Therapy. And this is a program that's looking at how you support a young person who has high levels of suicidality and has maybe attempted suicide a number of times, and one of their parents or a loved one or a carer. And they commit to a 26-week program to really learn all the new skills of how to communicate, how to emotionally regulate, how to know the warning signs, the triggers, and the ways to actually express that. And it's a complex program, but it's very intense because you're expecting someone to come for 26 weeks for 3 hours each week, not to miss one, etc. The success rate of that sits around 75% of attendees have completed the whole course. And that's normally our dropout rate of mental health services, you know, about 25% only people normally maintain contact, the rest drop out. So it's got a high success rate, so successful that the SA Health have now funded the program continually. So for 3 years, ourselves and the James and Diana Ramsey Foundation co-funded this program, and now it's been funded by SA Health. So that translation of evidence-based programs driving change is really, really important. And what was fascinating by this is that was done within a sort of a 3 year program, where historically a great idea in implementation into practice normally takes around 16 years. So we've managed to really focus on a program in a shorter intensive time, get research sitting behind it to drive a meaningful change. So that's that area where you truly want to look at. So when you're looking at deployers, we refer to them as organizations that say we'll fix it, but it hasn't been fixed yet.
Okay. Well, I guess and that's an interesting segue really into the sections of the importance of research.
Yeah.
And Ms. Muzi, we had a couple of questions in that space.
Yeah. So we know that people with sickle cell disease and other chronic illnesses have high rates of personality and mood disorders and mental health issues. So what are the most pressing mental health issues seen in individuals living with sickle cell disease and such chronic illnesses?
That's a great question. Now, I just as a disclaimer at the start, I'm not a specialist in sickle cell disease, but I can talk about sort of mental health and the wider implications of that. But what we do know, though, from a sickle cell disease perspective, you know, that comorbidity, so having a physical illness and the correlation to a mental health challenge at the time, often coexist, and that's why we call them comorbidities. And that's where, you know, there's a physical illness that's then impacting our mental health and our well-being. And physical illness can be impacting us because of a wide range of different changes. So pain and the management of pain, requiring to go for numerous medical appointments, not seeing any change, looking at those longer term negative prognosis from a physical illness, so sickle cell, not having a cure, going to be something with me for a predominant part of my life, impacting my number of parts of my organs, my cardiovascular system, neurological, and that then leading to that pain management, that then can lead then to that longer term secondary issue of experiencing depression. There's no hope. How am I going to get over this? I'm frequently going to appointments. No one really believes the pain I'm in. No one's understanding the discomfort I'm having. Who's here to help me? You know, so that cycle you sort of get into. So the depression can often be then correlated to that chronic pain, that fatigue, the physical impacts that sickle cell's having for me. The feelings of hopelessness of knowing that the journey I'm on is a long-term journey, so there's no quick fix. The days that I have good days, how long are they going to last for me before I become unwell again? And will I get into that cycle? So that's where, you know, we know that if people are experiencing sort of severe depressive episodes, so that impacts on my mood over a 2-week period with a prolonged impact on my physical health, well-being, my sleep, my diet, my exercise, my connection, my relationships, that's when they get that comorbidity coexistence. We also see, as you may have seen yourself, that higher presentation of anxiety. So the anxiety that might be in correlation to when I may be having a bad day or a deterioration that's experiencing, or the social anxiety of I've got to go for another appointment. I've got to prove what's happened to me again. The stigma of how I'm sometimes sort of accepted when I go for a medical appointment. You know, that first connection with our clinicians can be make or break. Those first 7 seconds of, hi, how are you doing today? This must be really hard for you. Let's work through our program, instead of, oh, they're here again. And what
That's
that might
right.
be like. Yeah, so you have those parts. But also the anxiety of missing out on connections, missing out on school, missing out on friendships, missing out on all those parts where they're all parts of our everyday life and our identity. All of a sudden, if we're unable to participate in them, that's then we're seeing that increase then of anxiety, which can be then presented with, you know, that shortness of breath, that rapid heart rate, that sweating, that feeling that everything's constricted, which sort of amplifies the physical feelings I'm already having. So, you know, we know that anxiety, the impacts on our gastrointestinal, on our coronary situations, you know, so all those things that trigger what's actually happening from my sickle cell disease at the same time. So those correlations. And then you've got that longer term chronic pain management and the mental strain that can take place for that. We have episodes of and people presenting with sort of symptoms very similar to post-traumatic stress because of how their mental health and physical health journey is actually happening for them, how they've been treated, how they've been either connected, their frequency of hospitalization, they're going for appointment after appointment after appointment, and that domino effect. And then finally, I suppose, parts then around the stigma and discrimination associated with this, you know, the misperceptions around the illness that's actually occurring. So what's actually truly happening to me, and do people understand it? Mm. Having to retell your story every time you go and trying to think, I've got to convince another doctor to believe me. So that domino effect, which then leads to, you know, that isolation. I'm not going to go to the appointments. I'm not going to go and see my friends. I'm not going to connect with people. So that disrupts, you know, our education, our employment, our interactions. So you've got this web that if we're not careful on how those first contacts are perceived, or the education that's happening, or the psychosocial education, or the information that's around the illness, as well as mental health issues, the domino effect can lead to that very severe situation for somebody.
No, you've expanded on a number of issues actually in there, and a few of those I was nodding away because I'm just going, yep, seen
that. Yeah, you've seen that yourself.
And how it's working. I guess staying on the theme of research, how well do you think current research captures the lived mental health experience of people living with CSD?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think the lived experience voice across research is only just growing. Truly listening to the lived experience voice, the connection, the involvement, the co-design. You know, really no research should take place unless you've actually got people who are experiencing what's happening as part of that whole program. And from a sickle cell perspective, it was really interesting. I was sort of Googling, going, well, I don't know of any research here in South Australia. I wasn't aware off the top of my head, but then, you know, there may be work taking place over in Samri, et cetera. But I did then sort of pose the question, well, what's actually happening here in Australia? And there's been some small benchmarks of some work that, and especially in that pediatric space about early intervention. So some work that's taking place up in, I think it's in Queensland, where they're doing the heel pricks to actually, sickle cell has been now identified as one of the diseases to sort of test within that heel prick
yes.
within babies.
So that early screening, intervention. That's right.
Screening, yeah. It's Queensland, isn't it? I think there's work then taking place on working around some holistic approach in migrant families, and I think that was in a Nigerian study that was taking place. But then there was like this void of well, what else is actually out there? And it goes back to the question around, from a lived experience perspective, how do we navigate that? How do we get involved in programs that may be of great interest here? How do we advocate for it, which is exactly what you're looking at doing? How do we raise that profile? So, you know, meeting with obviously our health ministers and having those sort of conversations, meeting with our research leads to say, what opportunities are there here? What grant opportunities are there? Because obviously from an investment perspective, it's looking at how does that sit in with the bigger picture on that mental health world. But also, how do you also validate why it's so important for sickle cell to be recognized at the same time as then every other illness is saying, how
That's
do we
right.
be recognized? Yeah. So I think it's not unusual that there hasn't been specific, really targeted research in sickle cell and mental health, because we're only just having, you know, those research conversations around survivorship and well-being within cancer and what that means. So which is an area that has an immense amount of investment, but we're only just making that correlation, those connections. So there's a definite gap. There's a definite need to actually explore more and how we could look at how we can get that embedded further into research. But also, how can it get embedded into our mental health services as well? You know, because I would suggest if you presented a majority of our mental health community services and started to talk about sickle cell, they'd be having the same conversations we are about how do we research that more? How do we understand more about it?
That's right. That's right. And I think but part of the things that we had noticed anyway, being frequent, my daughter's going for treatment every month at the Royal Adelaide, again, is again just that absence of even just that recognition that there's also the mental health aspect to the treatment that's required, and how can we incorporate that in the treatment as the people living with sickle cell coming in for treatment, whatever, you know, be presenting for it, if they have a crisis or coming in for their monthly transfusion.
So if you look at that then from your daughter's perspective, she might be able to answer this better for us. What does it feel like when you present every month? So you go in there and you're having a prescribed blood transfusion. What's that journey like? How do you feel when you walk through that door? Is there anyone asking you how your mental health is during that period? Is anyone helping you navigate that? What's the experience there for you?
Well, for the most part, since I've been doing this for as long as I can remember, I'm 19 now, and I think probably since I was 5, I've been doing this. So I think I've gotten used to it, but every doesn't make it any easier. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels like another thing. You know what I mean? I try and like not think about things until I have to think about them, you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
no, that makes sense. That's that part around living in the moment, isn't it? Which is really important. But has anybody ever asked you along though, you've been going there for 14 years, has everyone asked you about how is your mental health during this process?
I think it's very different, especially at the kids at the Women's and Children's. When I was a minor, they would often check in. There was play therapists, I was referred to a music therapist, and at one point, I did see a psychologist as well, and it was very the play therapist would come around and talk to everyone, and there was a lot of holistic approach compared to at the RA. I would come in, not even the doctors ask me how I'm doing mentally. They just think medication, symptoms, just physical challenges, and then that's it, and then they go and they move on.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Now, isn't that interesting that when you look at the intervention taking place within the children's services, all those different mental health touch points from the play therapy, the music, the connection, and to try and make the experience as reducing the distress as much as possible. But then, as we transition into the adult world, all of a sudden it just becomes a medical issue, doesn't it? And then not looking at those psychological parts. Maybe next time you go in and they ask you about your and how, what about the physical symptoms, maybe you should pose the question to them, mentally I feel okay as well, just to see what the reaction is. Only if you are feeling okay, obviously. But if you weren't, those conversations around, yes, my physical health is okay, but I feel like my mental health has been a bit challenged this time. It would be interesting to see what conversation took place from that. I'm not suggesting you go and do that and test it in any shape or form, but if that is what you were feeling, would you feel comfortable to do so?
Yeah, that's the thing though.
And that, what happens if I do say that? How will that be viewed? Is there any stigma associated still with having the mental health conversation where talking about the physical things might be talking about my wound site of where the transfusion's coming in, or what blood levels are being like at the moment, what my hemoglobin levels being looked at, all that physical thing, they're okay. But what happens if you said, actually, I'm feeling really anxious at the moment? It's the narrative around mental health is still seen with a level of stigma to overcome. Thank you for being so honest about your appointment, by the way.
It's okay, thank you. And going off the stigma and related barriers, what do you think are further barriers that people with sickle cell disease are facing that impacts their accessibility for quality mental health services and support?
Yeah, I think the barriers that a lot of people are sort of coming across are in relation to knowledge. So, what do we know about sickle cell? So is there good psychoeducation around that for us? Is there good psychoeducation around mental health? But also the barriers of actually accepting or accessing mental health services still remain. So there's still the stigma that's associated with it. So will anybody be able to understand me? Will they understand my needs? Will they be able to help me? No one can understand my complexity, so it's not worth telling anybody about. So we still hear those. And it's really interesting that I was talking to a colleague yesterday, and that they were just expressing some challenges they were facing in regards to sort of burnout and things like that. And then they said, "Oh, I've taken 2 weeks off." And I said, "Oh, that's great. And do you mind if I said, did you take that as annual leave or did you take that as sick leave?" And they said, "Oh, we took it as annual leave because I didn't feel I warranted taking sick leave for my mental health." Yet we have no issues about taking it for our physical health. And so even within our own environments, people are still carrying the stigma of reaching out for mental health support. So I think that our own perceptions cause that block and barrier for us. Our perceptions around people's knowledge cause that issues. Not people not believing, or a person that's experiencing that their illness, not believing that anyone else could understand how I'm feeling, and that personalization of their journey. But also historically, you know, your first presentation and first acknowledgement might have been quite negative. You just deemed as a number. You just deemed as someone that was coming through the clinic. The nurses didn't even use my name. The doctor even didn't even look at my face when he spoke to me. All those behaviours that we can experience can then cause the next block or the barrier. And in our mental health world, sometimes it might be I've spoken to someone, they didn't fix it, so no one can help me. Well, it might not be the right person you're talking to. So how do we look at those different things? Someone both described to me that they said, you know, if you were, I'd seen a psychologist once and you didn't get on with him, do you see another psychologist? And he said, if you called a plumber out to fix your toilet and they didn't fix it, you'd call another plumber out, wouldn't you? So why don't we do that about ourselves and find the right person that we can connect with? Because there's different approaches all the time. So I think really when we're looking around, how do we break down some of that stigma and discrimination? It's around trying to give really meaningful and clear and concise and accurate information that can help people. But also, as from a clinical perspective, us opening ourselves up to allow people to ask questions.
I think that's a really interesting segue, and I'm keen to just hear a little bit of your thoughts here, John, about again just that integration of mental health services in the routine care. Mm. What, in your opinion, would be some of the things, I guess, that you know would be considered as part of that integration?
Yeah. Again, when because we need to let your audience know, you did send me the question so I could prepare. Well, that was good. But when we look at those things, it is really interesting when you're looking at integrated service provision, especially when you're looking at, you know, you want it to be the experience to be positive. You want it to be effective as a person going in to receive care. I want to get good outcomes and good answers, etc. So I think just some of the things for us to consider there is there actually integrated psychosocial support within the health system for me? So have we got psychologists or social workers or clinicians actually embedded in the haematology clinics? You know, so is there that interface there? Have we sort of improved or got access to ongoing counselling or therapeutic support like CBT or trauma-informed care or interventions that can help me during those crisis times that are actually linked to the clinical time? So it's not seen as two separate things. When we're then looking around the pain management, you know, what else can be built into pain management that isn't just necessarily around the administration of medication? So are we looking at different coping techniques that can be built in? You know, so have you ever then, when you've been going for your therapy, have you done a relaxation class while you're actually doing your transfusion, or a mindfulness session, or biofeedback, or some CBT approaches? You know, how do we use that? Are we using psychoeducation, so listening to podcasts while we're having our treatment, so we're actually looking after our physical health and our mental health at the same time? From an interventions perspective, you know, who are some of the best people to provide support and care for you? Other people who've gone through the same thing as yourself. So are there any peer or community support programs? Are there lived experience practitioners in these environments or these clinics that can support us? Are there support groups, especially around, you know, the adolescent and young adults space, where the ability to talk, to connect, to understand is really, really vital, which might lead into sort of some mentorship or lived experience sharing and sharing of those appropriate messages. One thing I know that was important to you guys was looking at, well, how do we then support the family and the caregiver? So what's the mechanism we put in place there? So are we providing enough psychoeducation to the family to understand what's happening for their loved one, but also what's happening to the impact of that family unit? So what's the support for the family members, and you know, that being mindful of that looking after one of our siblings might have a negative impact on others, feeling left out, feeling the second person. I spoke to someone the other day that said to me that one of their siblings had a really challenging mental health problem. So for the rest of his life as a young person, he had to make sure he was perfect so he didn't add to the mum and dad's burden.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, so those pieces, how do we look at that? And then how do we look and support our carers? So making sure, you know, that we're managing any high levels of distress they're experiencing, any possible burnout, emotional strain, information sharing, or just the ability to go, oh, I just want to stop. And how do we build that in? I suppose from a school, university perspective, if I'm having an, if I had an early diagnosis, like you said, you started this journey at the age of five. What education happened with the school to understand what's happening to you during that way, and how can that actually help? And are there then tailored programs and make sure you don't miss out on your schooling? So if you're having lots of times in hospital appointments, how do we maintain that education? Because one of the issues we face with physical illness and mental health challenges is people dropping out of school, and then obviously that reduced educational impact. So how do we manage that? And then, from a South Australian perspective, one of the ways in which they've managed the sort of the mental health and well-being of young people is actually putting clinicians in schools. So that increase of psychology, of counsellors, of support. So we're normalising the mental health conversation within an education setting. So our teacher isn't our counsellor and our educator. They are just our educator. They may be the person we feel support from, but if we need more intensive support, we've actually got clinicians for it. And then I suppose the last couple, then how do we break down some of that stigma? So how do we look at initiatives and advocacy like you're doing to drive the change and give good information to people so they understand the implications and the impacts? And then what are the campaigns we can do? So we've got beautiful podcasts, but have we got further sort of marketing campaigns? Have we got really good literature that people can gain information from? Are there good websites that can that people can get information and resources from? Which sort of leads into that digital space around, well, how do you make that accessible for all? So I suppose the perfect world would have each one of those bits with a strategy sort of covered in. I'm sure there's other things we'd want to look at as well.
No, great insights. Thank you, John. It is again one of those issues, I guess, is and I think it's becoming quite apparent that I think you've touched on, aspects of the actual person living with the condition, as well as their carers and family, and also the type of support that they would require. And I would speak for myself. I think in a number of instances, I was quite unaware. I think you just get into what I call autopilot. Just go, we need to get this done. I ain't got time to process and do that. We just need to get this done. And it's only after some time where you become aware of it, you go, oh, I haven't processed this. Just been.
Or you meet somebody else and they share their story and you go, oh God, I was on
Exactly.
my own. I thought no one else was going through this with me.
Exactly. Exactly. No, really great insights for that. I was vigorously taking notes over here. But I think we've been speaking for a little while, so maybe we'll take a short break and then we'll be right back after this.
Bye.
Welcome back. You're tuned to 5EBI on 103.1 FM, celebrating 50 years of multicultural radio. Our guest today is John Mannion from the Breakthrough Mental Health Research Foundation, and he is speaking to us about mental health and its impacts, particularly its impacts with sickle cell disease. John, just before the break, I guess we were talking about some strategies and some interventions that can be used, as well as highlighting the lack of research, I guess, that's currently, and the gaps that you have identified in your organization with the work that you're doing, to try and push for a lot more research dollars to kind of go to fund the things that we know actually work, and also use that research, I guess, to kind of go, maybe let's rethink this strategy and redirect it in the way that actually makes an impact. In a society and in the communities that we're working in. We also now just want to pivot a little bit. I think I guess it would be remiss of us to kind of explore all of these problems and kind of go, okay, how can we then manage this? You know, speak to this young person. You know, I've been diagnosed with sickle cell disease, probably maybe a young, you know, still a toddler or working through an adolescent. I'm in that phase now with my younger daughters, you know, age between 19 and 23, having to navigate that space. What practical tips or coping strategies, you know, would you recommend that they could use?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I suppose it's looking at the strategies we use for all mental health challenges. So, have we made a safe space for someone to talk to us? You know, so where do we do that? Have we got, first of all, have we got time to have the conversation? Have we then found a sort of a safe space that, and using language that people are both comfortable with? And then really around, have we got good information to share or to gather together? Have we got the ability to listen and truly listen? You know, so how many of us, when we're listening to somebody, are already formulating the answer in our head before the person's finished talking? Now, we know that when we start to do that, we've actually stopped listening.
That's right.
Now, I, you know, I've got that problem-solving mind, and I want to fix it, and I want to get on with it, and what have you. How do I slow that down? How do I listen to what's happening? Because what's happening to one daughter and how they're experiencing their sickle cell might be very different than another sibling. Yeah. So not making those sort of assumptions. How do we ask questions that support sort of open conversations? We want to have those conversations, especially when we're exploring how someone's actually feeling, to be meaningful and to be engaging. So I've noticed you're not yourself at the moment. So that connection of the word I has shown that you're actually noticing something to somebody else. At a time when I didn't feel anyone would notice if I wasn't here, all of a sudden my mum's just reached out to me. Using questions that sort of, I don't understand what that must feel like. Would you be happy to share more with me so that I can hopefully provide the support you need? So again, learning and trying to gather more conversation points. Acknowledging what's actually happening is real. That must be horrible for you. I've never had that myself. Would you mind sharing a little bit more with me so I can understand more? So just looking at those ways in which we engage and not rush or push, I think it's really important. I think it's also important that we check back in, you know, so you don't have to have that conversation, that engaging conversation straight away and do everything and fix the whole package. You can do this over a number of times, but checking back in, how did you go yesterday? You were really anxious about X, Y, or Z. How did you go with that? Because again, it shows the way in which we were listening, we were truly connected, and we really validated what was actually happening for that person. And then I suppose then around it is around, what would you like me to be able to do to help? And I think there's often in our world, especially in the mental health narrative, we think we've got to fix everything. And actually, and I've worked in the mental health world for 38 years, and I've only fixed one person, and that's me. I'm probably still working on that now. But I've sat with a number of people who I'd made feel safe to share their story, to validate what was actually happening, to connect with them, to maybe signpost, maybe get the right support, and then check back in with them. And every one of us can do that. And I think it boils down to a simple concept of, we often talk about the three H's. Has somebody been heard? Has somebody been helped? or does somebody just need a hug? And that's personal connection. So I think if you, when you're looking around meaningful conversations, finding the right time, acknowledging that something must be challenging for someone because you've seen a change in them. So you will know when your daughter is struggling, you'll see changes in her behavior. She'll obviously tell you she's perfect all the time, but you'll notice there are changes when she might be more anxious, or she might be sharper in her response to you, or she might be worried about something, or she might not be looking after herself in the same way and she's neglecting herself. You'll notice those sort of things, and you can use those as signs to say, I've noticed a difference, so I just wanted to check in with you. So I think looking at those sort of approaches, but also that very clear mindset, it's not my responsibility to fix this, but I can sit next to you while we do it together.
I think those are great strategies that can help people like myself and others with chronic illnesses navigate that space, because it's very complex, you know, because you're dealing with, you know, especially teenagers this day and age, they already have internal factors and social factors that impact their mental health. So adding on chronic illnesses and chronic pain and chronic fatigue can just exasperate what we already see now in society. And I think that's really important that we discuss ways that we can cope, you know. And before the break, we were talking about gaps in research and what your team is doing over there. So what areas of research do you think are most urgent for the next 5 years?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. And you probably got the better answer to that than I have. And so I think gaps in research really would focus very specifically on the fact that there isn't a lot of research in this space, full stop, in Australia. There is worldwide, you know, obviously in America, there's been some really, really good work. But how do we advocate for that? How do we educate further to sort of look at those gaps? So how do we look at meaningful strategies that look at mental health and physical health together, but very specifically around sickle cell? So it would be remiss of us to say that every interaction around managing negative pain is the same, because it's not. So the pain you may be experiencing from sickle cell will be very different than the pain I'm experiencing from endometriosis, which will be very different than the pain I'm experiencing from prostate cancer. So how do we make sure that we advocate very specifically for sickle cell, and how do we raise that profile? So I think that would be one area that we should be looking at. I think, you know, classic from yourself, that younger person journey, you know, Mission Australia do a youth survey every year. And the top three things that have been coming up in for the last sort of 5 years has been around a stress, mental health and body image. Well, what's the negative impact on sickle cell on our bodies and how we view our bodies? And how we view, as you rightly said, that those internalizations that take place, that comparable theory that sits with how I use my social media and everyone else's life's better than mine and I'm at the doctor's all the time. So how do we look at, well, what's actually specific from a younger person's journey, and where do we start that research? But then also the piece of research then that obviously are looking around that physical impact. So the you know, building on the early screening, the early intervention, the prevention, the good strategies put into place. So we know in our mental health world, during the present federal election, an enormous commitment to investing into mental health, especially looking around youth mental health, yet not $1 was identified for research or early intervention and prevention strategies. So everything was around when the crisis has hit. Now, no one's going to say, please don't do that. But what happens if we stop the crisis happening in the first place? So how do we look at the research that should sit in that early narrative? And I suppose you guys are the experts on that. How do you raise that profile? How do you get organizations like Breakthrough to understand more about that? Not just Breakthrough, but all funding organizations to actually start to say, well, when could we start looking at this, and what do we need to do, and how can we sort of engage that? So that's that, going back to your earlier question about how do we get the lived experience voice really sitting around the table? I think that's really vital for us, because we need to learn more.
Most definitely. I guess in closing, John, we've touched on a number of points here, and I guess just want to give an opportunity, I guess, to yourself to just explore and share with our listeners some of the your upcoming collaborations or projects, if you're at liberty to share that we need to be aware of, and how can organizations or the community help support and participate in the research that you're doing?
Yes, yeah, sure. So Breakthrough Mental Health Research Foundation, or Breakthrough as everyone nicknames us, so that's the easiest way to do it. We can only do our work if we actually generate funds and investments. So we have a wide range of ways in which we fundraise, from people joining us on treks, where we've got around 50 people coming to do the Kokoda trek with us this year, and that's one of those activity fundraising that's often on people's bucket lists, and they fundraise, and that generates investment for us, which is great. We have corporate partnerships and sponsorships. We have events. So there's, I suppose it's from our perspective, is being mindful of our calendar of all these activities taking place. And we try and make sure that if from like an event space, it's not just a gala for us, it's actually about bringing people together in an education opportunity. So we have our men's meals and mental health event taking place on the 13th of June. We've got 638 guests joining us. They're not all men. About 20% of the room will be female, because often it's the partner that actually supports a loved one to actually come to one of these events, and they wouldn't come without them. That's sold out in 6 days. So what that tells us is that the narrative for men in the mental health world is growing. We never used to be that place. Never that we were obviously the very most challenged to reach out and request support and access support. But that's changing. That landscape's changing. And so what we're finding from that is that we're then building in education as part of that event. We're building in really meaningful lived experience speakers, so people can connect and make connections and real connections. And then we do some skills building as part of the program as well. So you come to the event, you're part of a bigger group, but you leave hopefully in a better place than when you arrived. And I think that's really, really important when we look at that meaningful activation across our fundraising. Without funds, then we can't invest into research. So one of our most successful areas is our world around our education and our training. So within that, we run a mental health awareness, suicide conversations, mental health first aid, men's community program, and a women's community program. And they're about early intervention strategies and breaking down stigma. Could you imagine if we developed a mental health program that actually then looked at mental health and sickle cell? And actually that awareness piece together, and how you could actually spread that word and make that further connection. Because your ultimate aim, obviously, is to continue to drive that narrative, but also to influence policy change that's taking place.
That's right.
So I'm doing some work at the moment. We have a community program called Mates Meals and Mental Health, which has a farmer's angle to it, looking around the stigma associated with reaching out for help during moments of crisis. And we're looking at, well, how can we develop and enhance that program to support the farmers and their wider community during the drought process that's taking place. And prior to that, it was during the floods, and prior to that, it was during the bushfire. So the next traumas. So looking at programs that are meaningful, that engage in, that alter and change, but also that are evidence-based. So all those programs are supported by our university partners, because then if we go out and run a program that's not evidence-based, then we're part of that 60% again, aren't we?
Exactly.
So our aim then for this year is we're working very closely with a number of partners to hopefully at the end of the year launch a grant round that really starts to look at younger people's mental health. And that we're working on some of those pipelines at the moment. It'd be wonderful that our aim is at the end of in October at our women's event to actually talk about it and announce this concept. And the aim around that is that, the evidence at the moment showing, that real challenge, as your daughter rightly said, the complexities that younger people are living in at the moment are very different than what we were brought up in.
That's right.
And those impacts and those changes, those influence that's taking place, the narratives that are there, the expectations that sit within us, the expectations that sit within a young person themselves, and then how we compare ourselves to everybody. So we need to break that cycle, and we need to sort of look at some meaningful research to explore that further. But then there's nothing saying that if when that grant round comes out, all of a sudden there's an application saying, what happens if we looked at the impact of sickle cell on younger people during this period of time, and can we explore that? So there are opportunities to drive change if we explore that in a very different way. So that's the role and function of who Breakthrough are. We want to invest in meaningful research. We want to support the South Australian community. We want to help in that education and that growth. And we want to normalise the mental health conversation, just like you're doing, so it becomes an everyday conversation. It's not one we need to be worried about.
No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for those insights. I guess on behalf of the our association, we just want to thank you, John, for your time. You have shared a lot of insights in here, and for our listeners, I'm sure you've picked up one or two things that you can practically use in your own life. Because again, as John had shared with those statistics, one in five of us has a mental health challenge, and so as we say on the program, let's just share a little bit of kindness. Let's be kinder to each other, because we have no idea what people are actually dealing with as we're interacting one with another. So
No, I
thank you
think
so much.
that's a beautiful segue to finish.
Yes, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And so to our listeners, if you're a person living with sickle cell disease, or a parent or a carer, or please reach out to us on 0406 56905. That's 0406 56905. Remember, John talked about having some peer groups and communities that can help you support. We have a community here of sickle cell carers and persons living with sickle cell as well, that you can connect with, and we can share and have those opportunities where we can share our stories and be heard. And just want to remind you that you're not alone. We're in this together. Until next time, it's goodbye.
Shape. We are diamonds, taking shape.